1 Peter chapter 5. It's interesting as we come to the end of this book. Actually, we haven't done a few more verses we could do, but we come to the end of this incredible epistle. There are themes that have run through this book that we will see as we come here, but I remind you that this section where we are is one of the clearest statements to the body of Jesus Christ, no matter where that body may be, about how we before God need to live. And if we live this way, I guess I've got to tell you, so many of the problems we face in churches wouldn't exist. But may I say to you also, this passage is one of the clearest passages about how a marriage ought to function. It just is. But remember, that's not surprising because just, you see, the church is the house of God. And the home and the marriage is nothing more than the church in miniature. That's what it is. The principles that apply to the church apply to the home. The principles apply to the home apply to the church as it goes this way. So we look at this passage, and I hope that you as husbands and wives will, as you ponder this passage, will understand it's dealing with elders and people in the body, but it goes far beyond that. Because, as we know, we deal with the issue of the pyramid, which we'll come back to later, this full force to understand its implication, this passage. But the real question we ask ourselves is, what is God saying to you? What is God saying to me? Because this passage is so pertinent to you. I'm just going to tell you, it doesn't matter who you are here today. The message of this passage is so crucial to your life. If you want to rationalize and do it your way, disaster, my friend. If you want to do it God's way, there's blessing, unbelievable blessing. So look at this passage with me. And I again remind you, you must look at the broader context. And so we'll go back and look at what we did last week together. But we're faced with a serious realization in this passage in verse 1. Where he says, I exhort you as a fellow elder and a witness sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory to follow. First of all, just to remind you, what he's saying to them is the answer to this church is the answer to the church down the street, the church down this road, the church in another state, the church in another country. It doesn't matter where it is. This is how it is. It transcends any cultural implications. It just does. So we have common problems, and whatever God has given to us in this body to resolve our problems, he has given to every church in the world, and this is the resolution of it. We have common prospects. We're all looking forward to glory. And it is true. I would wish, I just sang this morning, would wish that day would come. I long to be home, long to be home. I enjoy what I do down here, enjoy life down here. There's not a day that drags for me, but I long to be home. And the sooner he takes me there, the happier I'll be. But you see, the all anticipation is glory. It's what it is. It begins this book, it ends this book, you see. But in the middle of this, just to remind you, the witness of the sufferings of Christ. Now, when you look at this, you say, he alone saw Christ suffer. It is true, not these people to whom he writes. But he's not saying it to separate himself from them, but to remind him as a theme of this entire book is, look at the Lord Jesus Christ. Look at him. Look at him. Even this morning again, reading in the Gospels, look at him. And I'll tell you, Peter was frustrated by the way that Jesus lived, by the way that Jesus led. He was. It took him so long to understand how to do it. But let me tell you, the way Jesus did it isn't the way this society does it. It isn't the way you and I naturally do it. And somehow we need to walk beyond what we are naturally accustomed to and begin to do as he would have us do. So with this in mind, we come to this section, but we're faced with a solemn responsibility, all of us. So let's just quickly, what are we to do? Well, what we all as God's people are to do is we looked at chapter 5, and it's so crucial to us because it is foundational to everything. Notice, if you will, the center of the verse 5:5. It is the theme of this the entire first section. All of you, in relationship to everybody else, with humility of mind, put on the apron of a slave. Literally, tie on a string. Now, again, I remind you, for Peter to tell us this and say, this is the answer to the church, he fought it for so long, we fight it. It isn't the natural inclination we have, it just isn't. We have a tendency as husbands to lord it over our homes. We have a tendency as church leaders to lord it over others. We'd like to say we don't. We talk about servant leadership. But you see, when it comes to this, all of us, in relationship to everybody else, put on the apron of a slave. It's what it is. There's no place in the body of Christ for anybody who is not a servant. It's just we're all deacons, if you will. By the way, just so that you understand this, it isn't something somebody makes you do. It's something you choose to do. Look at the last verses of 1 Corinthians 16 sometime, not now, but look at them, if you will. It says, the household of Stephanas, they were the first believers in the area. They could have said, since we're the first believers, we're going to run this place. No, you know what it says? They appointed themselves as a family to be the deacons or the servants of the church. And it says, take note of such men and imitate them. This is where it is. Now, that's what we all are supposed to do. What God's leaders are supposed to do is interesting because as you look at chapter 5 we saw last time, interestingly enough, three verses are given to elders and only one verse to the people who are younger. But it's interesting because the elders are placed first and not because they're more important. No. This is the only place in the New Testament where those who are being submitted to are considered first. And they're not considered first because they're more important. They're considered first because it is so difficult for leaders to understand that they must be servants. And I say to you as husbands, it's so difficult for husbands to understand their primary role is that of servanthood in the home. And again, I remind you, the reason why you're afraid to put on the apron of a slave and to serve in your home is you're afraid the family will take advantage of you, and they will. But that's the essence of our role in leadership. Quickly, notice what happens, just so we go and look at this last week, just reviewing it. The leader's role in ministry, there are three things. They're called elders. And by the way, there's some degree of age involved in her maturity. Age by itself doesn't prove anything, okay? But certainly there is maturity involved in here without a doubt. They're overseers, they're shepherds, and the focus is going to be on this latter. The elders are to shepherd the flock of God. Again, we saw last time the shepherding the flock is the among you flock of God. The relationship to ministry, how we're supposed to do it, those voluntarily and eagerly. And this is the crucial part. You see, it's interesting. Do you know, you say, well, people are supposed to arrange themselves under us. Yes, because we have arranged ourselves under him. He is the chief shepherd. We're not the chief shepherds. I don't like the term in the context of the church. I don't mind using it outside of the church to help people understand, but the term senior pastor, whatever that means, maybe it means you have gray hair. But I recall when I was called to a church that some of you are familiar with, that the associate told me after that happened, he says, now you are the CEO. I says, don't you ever refer to me that way again. Very fascinating. Sometime later, he came to me and he says, you know, when you came to this church, it was the staff up here and the leaders down here. Now it's them up here and us down here. And I says, you don't understand. We're talking side by side. There's no over under the body of Jesus Christ. Otherwise, you don't understand the body of Jesus Christ. It just doesn't exist. And for those of us as husbands, we provide leadership in the home. We must, we should. But not to lord it over. We are submitted to the chief shepherd, and we understand that lording is not a part of our thing. What the members must do, be submissive. Now, reminding you a theme that runs through this book. We've seen submission in society in chapter 2. We've seen submission in work in chapter 2. Now, someone's going to say, hold it again. And I remind you, as I did then, it says, slaves, be submissive to your masters. You say, it doesn't apply to me. Absolutely, it does. Peter chose the worst possible case scenario so nobody could get out. See, if he'd said, submit yourself to your bosses, some would say, you don't understand, I'm a slave. He says, okay, I'm going to take a slave then. And some would say, but you don't understand, my boss is a crooked boss. So he uses a crooked master in there, see. He does it on purpose to say, if a Christian who is a slave and serves a crooked master must be submissive to him, how much more so should all of us be submissive? I cannot say it enough to those of us who are believers. Don't talk the talk if you don't walk the walk. If you're going to be a believer at work, you should be the best employee there is. And I know Christian employers who've told me that they're bothered by Christian employees who come to work and they're so zealous at the beginning, but after a while they say, you know what, they don't say it realistically, but somehow he's a Christian, I'm a Christian, therefore maybe I can take some more advantages. So you come in late from lunch and say to him, well, I was out witnessing to somebody. My friend, you have an obligation. Be the best you can be as a believer in Jesus Christ in that capacity and submit yourself, arrange yourself under, or you're equal before God. But you have a role of submission before God as well. But enough of that. Submission at work. Submission in the home, chapter 3, verses 1 to 7, and now submission in the church. It is significant because so many people looking at the book of 1 Peter, they talk about suffering. May I say to you, if there's a word that should override this book, it's submission. But now hear me carefully. It is submission in the context of suffering. For if one should submit in the context of suffering, how much more should one submit in the context where things are not involved in suffering? So submission is a major theme of this book, and he now brings it to a head right here in the context of the church. There is no place, those of you who are younger, for thinking that somehow you can do better than God at trying to clean up the mess in the church. It's God's church, remember, and he can clean up the mess himself. He does an incredibly good job. And I say that, I don't like to say it because it sounds like I'm being trite with regard to him, and I'm not doing that. I'm just trying to make a point with regard to you. Somehow we are bothered because we somehow don't think God can do well enough himself, so we want to do it for him. Don't try to do his job for him. He raises his children very well, thank you. Love that passage in Romans. Each man shall stand or fall before his own master. And then it says, he shall stand. God knows how to raise his own children. Understand that. He doesn't need you to raise his children for him. Does need you to come along and encourage and call them back to you. But submission is the issue. Why are we to do this? Because, notice the statement, why we must do this? You live any other way, my friend, and I tell you, you're fighting God. Notice the last part of verse 5, God is opposed to the proud. The word for submission is hupotasso, to arrange yourself, tasso, under. But the word that is used here is antitasso, which is to arrange yourself against. Same ending of the word, but the first part is different. If you don't walk a life of humility and submission, my friend, God is going to fight against you. He just will. He will. It's a military term. It's a general setting himself up in battle array. And my friend, God will fight every step of the way if you decide to live differently. He just will. With this in mind, it is interesting, you see, God gives grace to the humble, but he's opposed to the proud. We live in a day when, back then, they did not care for humble people, and today we don't much care for them either. But it is the path to success in God's church. Now, the question comes, how are we to do this? And why this is so crucial that you understand is that verses 6 through 11 should not be separated from verses 5 to 10. And you can see the word therefore that tells you that it is connected. And I remind you again, you when you see the word therefore, you must ask yourself what it is there for. There is no doubt that verses 6 to 10, 6 to 11, are integrally connected with verses 5 1 to 5. First of all, If the key to success in godly leadership in the church is found in verse 5b, then the key to carrying out God's leadership in the church is found in verses 6 and following. See, the great part about the Bible is this. It doesn't just tell you what to do. It tells you how to do what you're supposed to do. It doesn't leave you in the dark. You stay in the context. If you understand the context, it will define itself very clearly to you. Fact of the matter is, the focus changes here as well, because in verse 5, the humility is viewed as an attitude towards others, but now in verses 6 through 11, it is viewed as an attitude of humility towards God. Now, let me tell you that we don't, none of us want to admit this, but it's true, see. If we do not walk in humility before each other, it's because we're not walking in humility before Him. It's just true. I mean, it has to be. Because if He is the one who tells us how we're to walk, and we do not walk the way He tells us to walk, then you see, we're not submitting ourselves to Him. We're not humbling ourselves before Him. So as you look at this context, it's an important thing, because verses 6 through 10, 11 will show us how we're supposed to do what we find in verses 1 to 5. Three subjects that stand out. God, throughout this whole section. The devil. Notice, we find him here, be a sober spirit, verse 8, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about. The devil is found here. And humility is found here. Remember, I just stop with the devil for a while. Did you understand something? Just think about this. The longest section on submission, other than 1 Peter, is found in Ephesians chapter 5 and 6. Submission in the context of the husband and wife, submission in the context of the parent and child, submission in the context of slave and master. What is the very first thing you find at the end of this section on submission is what? We wrestle not against flesh and blood, right? But against principalities, against powers, and take on the full armor of God, that you may be able, in the same verb as here, that you may be able to stand against the devil. I was with a believer the other day. A divorced believer the other day who was telling me about a friend of his who claims to be a believer as well, who has been unfaithful to his wife. And the wife, by God's grace, is hanging in there, wanting this marriage to work. But he said to me, he says, you know, someone was saying the other day that God is dividing. My friend, listen to me. It's the devil that is dividing, and he's doing it big time. He just is. Why you look at these sections on submission, whether it's here, notice, even the passage in James, whence comes wars and fighting among you, come that out hence of your lust that wage war in your members. You lust and cannot have, therefore you kill, you see. So how you take care of this? You humble yourself before God, but then you what? You're supposed to again stand against the devil. It is amazing, because in every section that deals with submission to each other, the devil comes in here. The last thing the devil wants in the home, the last thing the devil wants in the church, is a lifestyle of submission. It's the last thing he wants. That's why it's intriguing that the strongest sections on the devil here in the New Testament come in a context where the church is called upon to walk in a life of submission. You're struggling in your marriage, my friend. Let me tell you, by the way, just so you go back and put it in the context of James, you understand those external problems come because of internal struggles. The problem you have with your wife, my friend, if you'll understand it, is a problem inside of you, not outside of you. She is not the problem, you are. Same way as your wives deal with your husbands, just understand that this struggle comes from within. And so when you're dealing with them and they are succumbing to sin and to temptations, understand it's the devil you're working against. You're wrestling not against flesh and blood. It's not the husband and wife. Never forget, it's happened so many times, but the one time when you're called to a home and the wife is in the house and you have the husband out by the car and the police are standing there between the two of them, say. These external struggles come because of internal struggles. And the last thing the devil wants to do is have us have the right attitude toward each other. He just doesn't want it to happen. So when you're dealing with it and you start doing these railing against your husband, your wife, understand you're not wrestling against flesh and blood. It's the devil. And he's at work, big time at work. And the impact he's making today is unreal. But you notice this, but you can't miss it. You don't want to spend all the time here because God is the primary focus. So as you look at this passage, no doubt it's here. Now, the command. Look at this section. First of all, therefore, since we're supposed to walk in humility, and look at this, if you will, in verse 5, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourself with humility. For God is opposed to proud, but gives grace to the humble. So you have humility and humbleness in verse 5. And now, therefore, the first word in verse 6 is humble. By the way, it is interesting. When you look under this context like this, you see God gives grace to the humble, and therefore the first word he picks up on is humble because humility is the issue. But humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. Sometime, and again on your own time, do me a favor. Just do yourself a favor. Read through Exodus. And then read into Deuteronomy. Just go straight from Exodus to the first part of Deuteronomy. And actually, I'll even tell you, go from the last part, the middle part of Exodus on to the first part of Deuteronomy. Just read that. Looking for one thing only, mighty hand of God. Just look at it. It is an amazing thing. He's running through there over and over and over and over again. It's fascinating because he uses it there. It's used in the context of deliverance. It's used in the context of discipline. Now, let me just, with regard to this, just stop here for a bit because, well, let me go down here just for a bit. I'll come back to that. The interesting part, one of the great, great verses. See, Moses tried doing it himself. And you and I, when we're younger, we tried doing it ourselves. I walked away from a very menial task yesterday. But I thought it was going to be difficult, and all of a sudden it became so clear to me how to do it. And I'm driving in the car alone, and I said to God, I don't take this for granted. Well, I know I've experienced doing this kind of stuff a lot, but it's just amazing what God does. Even the smallest issues of life, God is the one who gives us that clarity of thinking. As you look at this, it's fascinating, though, because we try so hard to do it ourselves at the beginning until finally we get the message. Moses, he tried to deliver on his own. He walks in there and he kills the Egyptian. He thinks, this is great. They're going to rally behind me. They didn't rally behind him. God had to send him away for 40 years. 40 years. Until he finally became so humble that God now calls him back to the task that he had wanted to do on his own, and he refuses to go back because he doesn't think he can do it. But finally he starts back, and then God makes a statement, nobody can deliver from under Pharaoh's mighty hand. And the first thing you say to yourself, then why in the world are you taking me back there? You see, Moses, you tried it your way, and it didn't work your way. Listen to me carefully. It will never work your way. It won't. Try. You get to be an older person one day, and you'll look back and say, if only I had listened to him. You see, because, and we talked about it last time, it's amazing when he comes back, because when he comes back, he's different than so many of us. We want to go in there. We're going to make it happen no matter what. And the first thing he does, he goes to the elders of the land. It's the last place you want to go. No, I'm serious. Okay, hear me. These elders have been in the land for 400, not these elders, but the people of Israel have been in the land for 400 years. I tell people when they get it, they say, boy, the church has got a year's history. It's 100 years old. I said, don't go there. You get a 100-year-old church, my friend, they are so mired in stuff that they won't get out of it in a hurry. They just won't. 400 years? Try to move that. But you see, he went to the elders first. He didn't go around them and just walk in there and try to do it. He walks through the elders. That's how you do it. You go through them. With regard to that, may I say to you, I've learned a lesson for me. All forms of manipulation are wrong. I'm not saying it for you, just for me. They just are. I don't believe any manipulation on my part in any relationship is right. Just don't believe so. And I resolved that so clearly. Went to a church to minister. And I made a suggestion to the leaders of the church, and they rejected it. And I said, that's good. It's only a suggestion. See, if it's of God, it will go. If it's not of God, it won't. It doesn't matter. See, it doesn't need your strength or your ability. And in fact, in that church, the chairman of the board was a millionaire, and he pretty well controlled what went on. And you see, I met with him every week on my choice. But I didn't have him come to my office. I went to his office on purpose because I determined if this was going to be of God, God would have to do it on that turf. But it's interesting because as you look at this context of this, you see, he came to me the next day. And he says, I know you were trying to manipulate us last night. He couldn't figure out how in the world I was trying to do it, but he could not believe that he wasn't being manipulated. It just wasn't something he understood. My friend, you go through leadership, and if God decides to make it happen, he will do it. It's not up to you to make it happen. It's up to him to make it happen. Then he went to the people. You've been in churches long enough. You've been sold a bill of goods. You've been sold a bill of goods by the politicians in the land, and you've been sold a bill of goods by church leaders. They'll tell you part of the story. You know what? None of us, we're right in the middle of this illegal alien bill, right? None of us knows what the truth is. We don't. I don't get into one side or the other, but none of us knows what the truth is. We just don't. And see, what's happened in churches, you're part of it, you get out there and you tell all the truth you want to tell, but you don't tell everything. No, you walk through the people and say, we've been here for 400 years, and it's time to make a change. And my friend, it wasn't 50 people, it wasn't 100 people, it added up possibly to over 1 million people and maybe bigger than that. Went through the people. Then he went right up to Pharaoh, right up to Pharaoh. We're going to go right through this man. We're not going to go around him. We're not going to sneak out of here. We're going to go through him. Watch churches over the years and church leaders try to go around governments. You don't. You go through them. And you see, the beauty of it is you understand all of those plagues that happened, it was God intervening. And the clearest one is the one where you go and sacrifice and put the blood on the doorpost, you see, and then you go in there and you trust God that when the angel of death passes over, he's going to pass you, and you have the faith to believe and to do as God tells you to do. And then you get to the Red Sea. By the way, as many of you know, I do make it a point to go out and meet unsaved people on the golf course, and I played with a man one day, never played with him before, and we got to the end, and he's sitting in the back of his pickup, and I have my van, we're changing our shoes, and he says, you want to hear a joke? Huh? I says, not if I can't tell it in church next Sunday. He didn't say another word. But I get there one day, and a fella knew how it went, so he says, I have a joke to tell you. I says, you do? And he says, yes. He says, Johnny, he says, went to Sunday school. That was a good start. Johnny got home from Sunday school, and his mother said, what'd you learn today? Now, I was amazed this guy knew this much about the Bible. And so he says, you know what happened? Johnny says to his mother, he says, what happened? Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. And he came to the Red Sea. And what he did was he blew up all these pontoon boats and they got across to the other side. And then he got his walkie-talkie and called in for the Air Force and they came and bombed the Egyptians. And his mother said, Johnny, that's not what the teacher taught you. He says, you're right, mother, but if I told you what the teacher taught me, you'd never believe it. Now, you know the story, my friend. It is an unbelievable story that God parted the waters and God brought them through to the other side and God overcame the Egyptian army as they sought to go through the same way. See, the issue is God can do. See, we do not, listen to me, we do not believe in the power of God and we do not believe in the power of prayer. You see, I do, and you say, I gotta tell you, you don't, and I don't, not as I should. Somehow, see, we have to do it for God because somehow we don't understand. See, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Listen to this verse. Moses is recounting the children of Israel at the end of his ministry, but this is about the first part. But I love this. O Lord, thou hast just begun, I put that, to show thy servant thy greatness and thy mighty hand. I saw all that he did in Egypt. I saw what he did in the Red Sea. I saw him not only part the waters, but in the middle of the desert from a rock cause enough water to come out in the desert so that all the people had enough. I saw him the day when the people were fussing over the food God gave. So God gave so much meat that came right down to them that they got sick in the meat that was given to them. But you know what? I saw the rock and the water. I saw the Red Sea part. I saw all that he did in the plagues of Egypt. But in spite of all that I have seen, I have just begun to see the mighty hand of God. Listen to me. You haven't even yet begun to see what God can do, nor have I. And the reason is not because he can't do it, it's because we have not brought ourselves to the place of humbling ourselves under his hand to recognize that he can do it, see? Well, I know we rationalize in marriages and say, well, they ought to separate or they ought to do this or they ought to do that. It's amazing what we do. I'm not trying to get off on that specifically. I'm only saying to you, we rationalize this stuff because we don't believe in God's power to reconcile, to heal, and to solve this problem. We just don't believe in the power of God, and we don't believe in the power of prayer. We don't. Just believe me, you don't. Just believe me, as much as I've seen God do in this last week, I've seen God do some unbelievably mighty things. But I have only begun to see what God can do. See, the reason why we don't humble ourselves under each other is because we're not willing to humble ourselves under him. See, we wouldn't be worried of people taking advantage of us because we'd understand that God can change their hearts so that they will not do so. It's not ours to force them into a place of submission. It's God to bring them to the place of submission. And so as you look at this interesting part with this, this is the word, but it's fascinating because it's also used majorly in the context of deliverance, but also used in the context of discipline. But it's intriguing because the statement is true. The God who brings discipline is the God who brings deliverance. See, if we'd only understand in some of the suffering we face, it's suffering that God brings for the sake of discipline. And if we'd only understand that it is he who brings this for the sake of discipline, and it is only he who can deliver us out the other side. I have personally talked to the elders some time back, and I have watched God make his will known in the past, but I did not recognize it so clearly, so I found a solution to the problem myself. Wasn't an evil thing, it wasn't a willful thing, I just did it. But when I watch God doing things today, I'm determined to understand what he is trying to say. For this God who brings discipline is the God who brings deliverance. And the reason we cannot humble ourselves to each other is because we are not willing to humble ourselves to Him. We don't submit to each other because. I had in here, by the way, I changed it. We don't submit to each other because we don't submit to God is what I put in there, but I changed that. We don't submit to each other because we won't submit to God. I come back to this. I must move on. Notice something else, the promise. He will exalt you in time. Let me talk about this just for a moment, because you understand this book from beginning to end, it is an eschatological book. I know you don't comprehend that, nor do I as much as I should. I have been studying this book for so many years, but it took me so many years to figure this out. The exaltation, the enkairos is here, or enkairos, the word, the construction is used here, has to do, it's an eschatological term. You say, hold it. God is bringing me through this time of trial, and God will exalt me here. No. Don't do that. May I take you to the example of Jesus Christ? God never did vindicate him this side of glory. He didn't do it, see. Jesus died on the cross as a common criminal, he did. He humbled himself by becoming obedient unto death, Philippians 2, even death on a cross. Even death on a cross. Listen, Hebrews, despising the shame. It wasn't just the physical problem. It was the shame of a cross. He despised the shame. Humbled himself, becoming obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Wherefore, God hath highly exalted him. Here? No. My friend, if somehow you are looking for exaltation here, don't do that. Now you say, God may give you exaltation here. If he does, that's good that he does. Thank God that he does. Praise God that he does. But that's not a part of the deal. Just isn't a part of the deal. You don't need to be vindicated here. This isn't about you. It's all about him. It's all about him. It's not about you. If only we could understand that. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's all about him. So if God vindicates you, and I would sometimes love vindication. I would, my friend. I've been through a series of things the last two decades, and it's amazing to me. And I think to myself sometimes it would be, somebody said that, can't you sue? Oh, sometimes you'd love to go to court of law and have it all out there, but people can say what they want in the church, and it doesn't matter, see. Yeah. But you know what? If you're into vindication here, my friend, you'll start doing it your way. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, and he will exalt you in time. In his time, by the way. And if it's like the master, it won't be here. I must move on. We'll not make it through. But watch this. The second one, this is a beautiful thing. Cast all anxiety upon him. Now just to remind you again, the word anxiety that is here, by the way, for free, let me just do for free to some of you. As you look at this, this is a participle, okay? But it follows the imperative of the previous verse and therefore is imperatival because of that. But I leave you with that. That's for free. Peter does that a lot. Cast all anxiety upon him. Now listen, it's a singular. It's not only a singular, it has the article in front of it. Now hear me carefully. You know, in Matthew, Jesus is talking to the disciples, as well as he's talking to the multitude, but you know he's trying to make the point of the disciples. He says, stop being anxious. Twice he uses the present imperative. Stop being anxious. Because I know you're anxiety-ridden people, he said. But at the end, when he talks about anxiety again, he uses another tense because he says, and don't ever do it. If you will, don't ever do it again. We are to stop being anxious about anything. Be anxious for what? Philippians? For what? Nothing. Nothing. We'll come to this moment. Be anxious for nothing. But see, the interesting part of this, we love anxiety. Everybody does it. Everybody does it. I mean, sometimes if you don't have anxiety, you have no conversation. So therefore, let's get into it, okay? Because everybody else has something to worry about. Let's get into it here. So anxiety, everybody does it, but also it's so comfortable to do. Like it to a dear friend of mine I visited just the other day. He had a shirt his wife wanted to throw away 100 times. But when she brought it up, he says, no, he says, that church shirt is just too comfortable. We love anxiety. It's everybody does it, and it's just so comfortable to do. But it's wrong. It's wrong. And here in this passage, it's not every time you get anxious, give it to God. That's not what he says. God says, take away the totality of anxiety. See, it's fascinating with this because all anxiety must go. Listen to this. He who accepts what God ordains will also relieve the resolution of his anxiety is God. See, if you believe that God is in control, if you believe that God is the one who directs your life, all of these circumstances of life, you see, if you can leave the resolution of those things to God, you can leave the resolution of your anxieties to God too. By the way, listening to a man in another context talk about this one time, I was intrigued by it, and I don't want to go off on this because it's not the context here, but he says, you know, it is the expectations that we set up that create the anxieties. And you deal with those expectations. I think it's true. See, when we start expecting someone to do something, we become anxious when they don't. Even when we expect God to do something, we become anxious when he doesn't. It really has a lot to do with the expectations that we have created. Not God-ordained, but self-ordained. And when those expectations don't come to fruition, then, for example, we become anxious because of it. All anxiety must go. All of it. All of it. As you look at this, it's interesting because this is Philippians, and I put it another different way because I'm so used to being anxious for nothing, but have no anxiety about anything, but in everything with prayer and petition make your requests known to God. Listen to me. May I quote James? To him who knows the right thing to do and doeth it not, to him it is sin. If you know it's wrong to be anxious and you become that way anyhow, my friend, it is blatant sin. If I do, it's blatant sin. Okay, it's real stuff, okay? I don't want to keep making the payments on this place. I thought the place was sold. It's not sold. It's on the market. The market is slow. I know that. The easiest thing to do is to say, God, how in the world are we going to do it? See, it's so easy to go there, see. Be anxious for absolutely nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing. You say the problems are big. My friend, the problems of Egypt were bigger. The obstacles are impossible. They were more impossible there than they are in any situation you're facing. Now, let's keep going. Notice, by the way, anxiety, all anxiety is a contradiction to true humility. It just is. Don't somehow think that you can be humble before God and be anxious at the same time. It's impossible. Now, with regard, move on. Notice the promise. Oh, you love this. He cares for you. You know what's so beautiful about this passage? It's actually put a different way, which I sort of like, so let me just do it this way. Because to him there is a care concerning you. Because to him there is a care concerning you. Listen, there's no detail of your life that he doesn't care about. No detail. You know what I don't want to stop doing? I've changed my prayer life a lot, but there's some things I haven't changed. I remember in fifth grade up in Canada when my folks were on furlough. I remember losing a ball across the street in a bush. I remember walking across the street looking for that ball. As I'm looking for the ball, I'm asking God to help me find it. I don't want to become so mature I stop praying for things like that. I don't want to pray for them for the same reason that I've often prayed for them, for carnal reasons or for my own selfish reasons. But I don't want the small things of life to be held so somehow I can handle this part and God will handle that part. There is no part of my life that He doesn't care about. There's nothing that I'm dealing with that He doesn't care about. Nothing. What a promise. So now let me move on. Notice, though, this is the amazing part of this. In the context of this, this comes in here, it just rushes in here. By the way, it is fascinating because there we call this an asyndeton, and you don't even want to know what that is, but there's nothing that connects us with the previous. It just comes, it just smashes you in the face. We haven't had the devil. We've not been dealing with the devil. All of a sudden, the devil's here. And you know, it's interesting because when he talks about this in this context, it's interesting because, let me do this. It's interesting because as he uses it, one is trying to say, wake up! You know, listen, we don't understand, my friend, we don't. Where do these marital tensions come from? They come from the devil, my friend. He is the one who is inciting so much of this unrest in our soul. Wake up! Where is the unrest in the church coming from? My friend, he's fighting big time. Wake up. We need to wake up to understand. Listen, the other side to it is don't become so enamored with him because we can overcome. The problem isn't not overcoming him because he who is fighting for us is greater than he who is fighting against us. And it's true. We can overcome. But understand the battle is not something on the surface. It's far deeper than that. Wake up and pay attention. Look at this roaring lion seeking someone to devour. He's strong, he's aggressive, he's destructive. Go read Daniel. Daniel is praying. Doesn't seem like God's answering. The angel shows up and says, I've been fighting through the forces of evil to get here. Angels have to fight their way, my friend, to come alongside. They do. We don't understand. Let me just for a moment say to you, see, we say to people, you ought to pray more. No, listen to me. If you understood the plight you were in, you would pray more. Nobody'd have to tell you. So the fact we don't pray more, and there's not one of us who prays as much as they should, if we truly understood the plight, no one would have to tell us to pray. I've used it over and over again because dear brother Scott Florin, in the early years of this body, I got a call on a Saturday saying, Pastor, we need your help. My wife found she has cancer. And I walked down to the hospital down there, the county general, and I saw Scott going from one room to the other, begging people to pray for his wife. See, my friend, when cancer gets you and you understand the doctors can't do anything, the only recourse you have is to go to God. May I say to you, our predicament is just as disastrous as that. We're fighting the devil, and the only way to have any intervention is through God. The only way. The only way. We don't pray because we don't understand the seriousness of the condition. And even for those of us, see, we start out the day, and we think we can do part of this, and then when it really gets bad, we'll call on God. You need to understand before you even start, you can't do any of this. Without me, you can do what? Huh? Try me. Without me, you can do what? Nothing. See, there's some things that we think we can handle. Hear me carefully. Zechariah 4, you know it. Not by human strength, nor by human ingenuity, verse 6, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. Don't try to do your business without God. Don't try to do your schoolwork aside from God. But my friend, when God intervenes so graciously, be careful to recognize it's He who did it all. Okay, I must move on. Notice this. We must be prepared for the adversary. We must be steadfast in opposing him. No, by the way, it's interesting. The same term is used. It's fascinating because it's used in these places, Ephesians 6, James 4, 1 Peter 5 alone. Listen, He's strong, but I can stand against him. Antista. Stand against. Stand against. Stand against. Not in your own strength. No, 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 no. By the way, go to Ephesians 6 sometime and see all the armor of God, then see how much time he gives to prayer at the end of it. See, prayer gets more time than anything else. It is that sense of dependence upon God and the armor of God that helps us withstand the devil, and we can do it. He isn't the victor. We are through God. But now watch this, because we must move on. So go with this. What happens to do this? Now look at this great ending of this book, the God of all grace. After you suffer for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ Jesus will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, establish you. First of all, the God of all grace. Any problem you face, my friend, all grace. Not just some grace, all grace. The God of all grace who called you into his eternal glory. My friend, he's not going to call you and strand you. He won't do this. He who began a good work in you will what? Yes, he will. He will continue to perfect it. That's what he does. He won't strand you in the middle. He started you on this journey, my friend. He's going to see you through. By the way, the beautiful part, even take Moses, see? Look at what he watched God do for 40 years, watching him through all of that. Who called you to sin and glory after you suffer for a while. Now, let's take this in pieces. He himself will put the pieces together. Let me do this. The promise of our suffering. You're going to suffer. That's the theme of this whole book. Chapter 1, verse 6, you're going to suffer for a while. Chapter 5 now in verse 10, after you've suffered for a little while. May I remind you, this is in light of eternity. This isn't American little while. This is God's little while. We live in a fast food age. We want everything done in a hurry. God, give me patience and do it now. See, we want it in a hurry. The amazing part of all of this, you see, it is God's timetable, and you may suffer down here for 10, 20, 30, 40, even 50 years, my friend, in light of eternity. That is nothing. What causes this problem is when we fail to look at the eternal perspective, and this whole book is about that. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame? See, when you understand what lies ahead, my friend, you can suffer anything for a while. 10 minutes isn't a little while, okay? Hear me. A week isn't a little while. Understand God's divine plan, the promise of our suffering. But notice the promise of his sufficiency, all grace, the God of all grace. And then the promise of his personal provision. I want to spend time with this just for a while. It's interesting because who will do it? Notice what he says. It is fascinating here, and you don't have a Greek text in front of you, but I do, but only to say to you, the God of all grace who called you into eternal glory, after you suffer for a little while, and then the very first word is, he himself will do it. We get so big sometimes we send somebody else to do the work for us. My friend, he is so big and he never sends somebody else to do the work for him. He doesn't. Well, I realize he can send angels to do this or that, and he does do that. But when it comes to the problems of my life, he himself intervenes. It's so beautiful to know that when he's got everybody else to care for, he takes time for me personally. I can't get over it. Just one word. He himself will do it. He himself will do it. And my friend, he himself will do it, right? Not may do it. He himself will do it. Watch. Notice, if you will, the next thing. It says, when is he going to do it? After we've suffered, he's going to do it. By the way, sometime. Just go back to Zechariah 14. I love those first few verses, as devastating as they are. It says God is going to gather all the nations. God's going to do it. He's going to gather all the nations against Jerusalem. City's going to be destroyed. Women are going to be ravished. But you know what it says? Huh? I love the verse. And then the Lord will go forth and fight for them as in the day of battle. You say, why didn't he do it earlier? You know, he waits until it seems like, in fact, he does wait until there's no other way. But you know why it has to happen? Why not help Israel now? Because Israel doesn't know they need the help right now, see? And nor do we. You are in such dire straits this morning. The problem is you don't understand the illness you have, nor do I. And God brings us to the end of ourselves so that you see we are ready for his intervention, open for his intervention, because we realize there's no other way outside of his intervention. And then it says he will fight for them as he did. God loves to fight for his people. He just loves doing it. I told you, I was reading this morning. I'm in 1 Kings now, having a time of my life reading through there. Kings who just couldn't believe how God does things, see? Stand still, he says, and see the salvation of the Lord. Some trust in horses and some in chariots, but we will trust in what? The Lord our God. See, the issue is, it's after you suffer for a while, my friend. It's almost he has to wait to that point where you understand the seriousness of your predicament. Then you call on him. See, you thought you could do it so well all these years. I sat with a pastor across from his desk, and he says, I could control everything until. My friend, he was on the mission field in Africa, far away from the situation here in California, and his son got on drugs there. He says, finally, I realized I didn't have control. The beautiful part is watching God turn his son's life around and send him to the mission field a few years later. But I sat across the desk from a frustrated father who realized he wasn't in control. God was. And when he yielded it to him, God intervened, as God is wont to do. Notice this. What will he do? I want you to see this. I just quickly through this. Watch this. The first word. Notice what he will do. These words sort of pile up. He will perfect. It's this word, katartizo. It's all the way through the New Testament in different ways. But let me talk about this word. There was a time when in the Gospels it talks about they were mending their nets. It's this verb. It's when you're fishing with a net and you've got a lot of fish in there and you start pulling it up and all of a sudden you see half the fish go because they're getting through this hole and you realize you can't fish very well this way, so you repair it. So it'll be useful again. It's used outside of the Bible in a medical way where you take a broken bone and you repair it again so that it is healed, so that again you cannot even tell it was broken. This is what it is. You mend it so it's usable again. Are you frustrated in your marriage today, my friend, because there are things beyond your control? And they are. Trust him. He will himself put the pieces together. Broken pieces that you somehow don't think anybody can fix, he himself will. He will. He will. It's the assurance of this. But look, he doesn't just stop there. I know spell check doesn't like this, but it's the best way I can do it because it's not a, he established, he makes a solid. He's only going to just put the pieces again. He's going to give stability to this. And let me just keep going down through this because it just piles one onto another. He will then strengthen, and then notice he will establish a firm foundation. Let me tell you, years ago, a seminary professor, friend of mine, he came to my house. He said, I need to talk to you. My wife is seeing her boss. He's so blatant, he actually brings her right home to the back door of the house. I didn't know how to be there for him. I'm turning on a ball game in the house, just something to distract him. He's just walking the floor. Just walking the floor, back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. Before I poured the floor again, and it was a creaky old wooden floor, and he just walked the floor. He couldn't sit down. I'd stand with him next to him in chapel. Listen to me, if you ever call to speak to men in ministry, somehow you must understand you're still preaching to broken hearts, and you must do so. People don't realize that. They get up in settings like that. Some pious little message that shows how brilliant they are. I'm sitting with him in a pew, and only two other people in the world know this outside of themselves. And people are singing these hymns, and he can't sing. He's hurting, and nobody knows he's hurting. Nobody. But oh, my friend, God came in and put the pieces together. I went to minister at his request some years ago in a church he was pastoring, and walking alongside of him in such a valiant way as his beloved wife, God put the pieces together. God established, God strengthened, and God made a firm foundation. Listen, we get the place humanly. We don't see the remedy, my friend, but God is the remedy. He is the only remedy. There is no other. It's the essence of this book. It's the secret to victory in life. Now, I must move on because it's a great thing. The result of all this, look at this. Look at how this book ends. Shorter doxology than the last one. To him be the kratos forever. Now, you know why this is amazing? Because it's tied to the same word, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God in verse 6. And it says, because to him is the power in verse 11. Comes the same word. Humble yourself under God's mighty hand because to him is the might. Humble yourself under God's powerful hand because to him is the power. You see, the beautiful truth of this is this. You see, to him and to him alone be the power forever. Power belongs to him. That is why I say to you, there must be no centers of power in the church of Jesus Christ other than God himself. See, when you somehow, as a pastor, think that there's power vested in me, there's no power vested in you, unless you try to make it so, but it still isn't there. Leadership in the church start thinking maybe there's power vested in me. The only power in the church must be in God himself. Now, listen to me with regard to this. Just hear me carefully. Did God have the power to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt? Did he? Yes or no? Yes. And did he do it? Yes. But let me ask you something. When Jesus stands there and says, I could call for a myriad of angels to deliver me, did God have the power to deliver Jesus from that suffering? The answer is what? Yes. Did he do so? No. If God chooses not to deliver you from suffering, my friend, it's not because God does not care or because God is not able. It's because he has a greater purpose in it all. And had you see even the prayer of Jesus, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Had God answered that prayer in his behalf, my friend, you and I wouldn't even be here today. But now watch this, just as we do this. God can do. But God isn't obligated to do. Let me walk with you this because the pyramid, I start with it, I got to end here with it. You see, this is the key to it all. You see, if we start from the Word of God and do it His way, you see, then it is God's power that rules. If we start from our imagination and strength to resolve, it is man's power that rules, see. God says, this is the way. It is the only way. You choose to do it that way, my friend. Your power will be evident, but the solution will not be what it ought to be. So this book ends with this great truth. To God and to God alone be the power forever and ever. Amen. See, I want to die. And as I'm on, I want to go home, that's true. But when I'm ready to go home, I want to look back and realize he did it, not I. Many of us are sitting here today who have raised children. We did the best we could do, but I'll tell you what, it is the most unprepared you are for any job. And even when it's over with, you wonder how in the world you got through it. But when you watch your children walking with God, you recognize it is all of His grace and all of His doing. It's true. You see, you want to come to the end of life and look back and realize He did it, I didn't. May God help us. To Him be the power forever. Father God, what an amazing book, what an amazing truth. I have been trying to put pieces together for years, and Lord, only You can do that. I've been trying to solve the problem in my way for years, but only You can do that. So, our Father, we come to You as those who become frustrated at times because we're trying to make things happen our way. Teach us, our Father, the power of prayer. Teach us Your power. Help us to do it Your way and to trust You that You will, after we've suffered for a while, You will, with a certainty, put all the pieces together. You will establish us. You will strengthen us. You will make of us a firm foundation. To that end, we yield ourselves to You individually. We yield our marriages to You. We yield our families to You. We yield this, Your church, to You. To Him be the glory, to Him be the power forever and ever and ever.